You're listening to In Your Company on Cambridge 105.
Welcome to In Your Company, the fortnightly business show on Cambridge 105, presented by me, Sam Davis. Today, we're kicking off our autumn series by looking at the past, present and future of what is absolutely the biggest business story running in our region, and one which is of national and even global significance, the so-called Cambridge phenomenon. And I'm absolutely delighted to have with me in the studio as my guest, Charles Cotton. Charles has been intimately connected with the Cambridge business scene since the 1980s as both a highly successful serial entrepreneur and as an investor in early stage companies. Among his many other roles, he is currently the chairman of Cambridge Phenomenon Limited and author of The Cambridge Phenomenon, 50 Years of Innovation and Enterprise. Charles, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Shall we tackle the obvious question first? What is the Cambridge Phenomenon? It's a phrase that gets bandied about a lot, but is it an organisation, a technology, a group of people? Can you try and pin it down for us?
Well, I think it's all of the above, and the use of its name really goes back to 1979 when Matthew Bullock, who was Walter Herriot's colleague at Barclays Bank, organized a group of computer engineers to get together in a pub and discuss what was happening in the Cambridge area. And one of them, during one of those meetings, said, "Wow, this is so exciting. You know, what we have here is a phenomenon." So that was the first recorded moment when the Cambridge phenomenon was used together. And then in 1980, the Financial Times picked that up, and a cousin of Jack and Charles Lang, Petta Levy, used it in a lengthy article that she wrote about what was happening in Cambridge in an article in 1980. So it goes back a long way. And then when we decided that we wanted to set up an organization, we were looking around at an appropriate name, and I have a dislike for derivative names, and there are so many silicon thises and silicon thats. In fact, there's an organization called Siliconia that maps all of these, and I hate silicon fen, so we decided that the Cambridge phenomenon was distinct. It was very Cambridge-like as an original idea, and so we decided that we would use the term Cambridge Phenomenon Limited for our organization. And of course, then it plays back to the report by Siegel, Quince and Wicksteed in 1985 entitled Cambridge Phenomenon.
So Cambridge Phenomenon is about the entirety of the scientific technology-based business and innovation that goes on in this geographical area, is that right?
I think that's right. I just link the concept of business into that as well, because I think, yes, a lot of the companies have their backgrounds in science and technology, but then they have become entrepreneurial and have gone on to build businesses around it. So that Cambridge phenomenon is a very broad term that accounts for science and technology and business as well.
Okay. And to give us a scale of what we're talking about, how many businesses or employees are considered to be part of the phenomenon, and what's the kind of broad geographical area that it covers?
Well, I think we're talking about an area within a sort of a rough radius of about 15 to 20 miles. So from Huntingdon in the north, Newmarket in the east, probably St Ives in the west, and then down to Royston in the south. And within that area, you've probably got 250,000, 300,000 people, or maybe even more than that, within which the city of Cambridge is about 120,000. And that's the sort of area within which we have about 1,500 companies employing more than 50,000 people, and which has been the center for the evolution of all of these fantastic business and these fantastic experiences, which those 50,000 people and their predecessors over 50 years have experienced to the benefit of the Cambridge community.
Okay, well, we'll touch on the benefits later, but can we start by going back to the beginning of the story? You talked about the 50th anniversary. What was it that happened in 1960? I think that's the point at which you date the phenomenon really getting going, that was so seminal.
Well, there's a sideline to that, that I was sitting on the train coming back from King's Cross, looking through the Guardian, got to the obituaries page, which I don't normally read, and saw the obituary for Tim Ilowot. And Tim was one of the two founders of Cambridge Consultants. This is back in 2009. And it struck me that next year would be this 50th anniversary of the founding of Cambridge Consultants, which most people see as that seminal moment which catalyzed the emergence of Cambridge cluster of companies, the Cambridge phenomenon. And so this was that starting point for me, and certainly 1960 and the founding of Cambridge Consultants, I think most people see as being that moment which then stimulated the start of the cluster of companies in this area.
Yeah, because the mission statement of Cambridge Consultants was to put the brains of Cambridge University at disposal of the problems of British industry.
Yes, that's a wonderful expression, because I think that Tim, and have been few people who've had this, had the chutzpah to make such a bold statement. And I think that this chutzpah, which is one of the attractive things where you see some of the characters that have evolved in the Cambridge area over the years, to have that chutzpah and that approach is important for the evolution of what's become the successful cluster of companies in the Cambridge area.
Okay, so there's this kind of bubbling away of activity during the 1960s, which then started to take a more concrete form in the early 1970s. Now, that leads us on to our first interviewee that we're going to hear now, Walter Herriot, OBE. Walter played a key role in fostering the cluster of companies, first as director of manager of Barclays Bank in Cambridge, and then as the managing director of the St. John's Innovation Centre. And we're going to hear him talking a little bit about his first impressions of Cambridge when he moved here from Liverpool in the early 1970s, and then how his role has evolved.
When I first came to Cambridge, it was a very, from my point of view, dull place, very little enterprise. One of my colleagues, Matthew Bullock, spotted an opportunity to try and get the bank more involved in encouraging spin-out businesses from the university. He, unfortunately, from my point of view, was promoted to be assistant to the chairman of the bank, and I was the only other graduate they could find. So I was asked to sort of spearhead this activity, and that's what I did. And we got involved in helping people, mainly in the first instance from the engineering department and from the computer lab, in starting up their business by trying to explain how businesses operate and trying to create a sort of collective approach so that people felt that they weren't operating in isolation. We encouraged networking because people wouldn't talk to each other, whereas I thought it was a good idea if we share experiences. And we did it successfully. When we analysed eventually how our lending had gone, we've discovered that, much to our surprise, we lost more in the conventional sector than we did in the high-tech sector. Following on from the Barclays initiatives, Christopher Johnson, who was the senior bursar at St. John's College, became interested in how the college might develop the site, the land that they owned at Cowley Road and had done since the 1530s. The college decided to develop that, and Christopher Johnson took a sabbatical to go and look at initiatives throughout the world, and he finished up in Salt Lake City and came across an initiative in Utah whereby the university had set land aside for a building which would house first early stage businesses with a relationship with the university and would provide easy in and easy out leases. So unlike the traditional English approach, which was 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, would give us a guarantee, the leases were you could leave after a month and you could give a month's notice. And the property was for much smaller companies, so 500 square foot, suitable for four or five people, so suitable for startup companies. And this is how Christopher developed the idea. And the Innovation Centre itself was set up in, I think, 1987. I was involved on an advisory board. After about 3 years, it was decided we'd slightly change direction, and I was asked to come in and manage the Innovation Centre, both to make money for the college, but also to continue to encourage the growth of businesses and do what one could to reinforce the Cambridge phenomenon.
So can I just interrupt you there? What did that mean at that time, reinforce the Cambridge phenomenon? What was the conception of the Cambridge phenomenon at that point?
The Siegel Quinn's Wicksteed report, which was published in 1985, underlined the significance and the uniqueness of the development of this high technology sector around Cambridge, based on businesses spinning out of the university. And that was the where really Christopher started from. How could the college use its assets, make money, but also to help this process? And Trinity had done the Science Park, which was for more mature businesses, but it was perceived that there was a need to sort of help stimulate early stage businesses. Barclays had stopped supporting companies at that time because they felt they had done their job following the Siegel-Quincy report, which legitimised what they were doing. So, okay, Barclays stopped that and move on to something else. So there was a bit of a gap, and Christopher identified this gap and used the Innovation Centre building as a tangible symbol of the college's interest in early stage businesses. And also important, really, because it was a building where it was hoped that businesses would spin out of onto other parts of the park, as well as to the Science Park, but other parts of the Innovation Park. So there was a commercial imperative behind it, if you like, or commercial logic. And we were trying to stimulate the general startup activity around Cambridge, both by emphasising its importance and providing contacts, and also by providing advice and support ourselves. I used to advise around 250 to 300 companies a year when I ran the Innovation Centre from 1987 through to 2008.
And you did this with a great measure of success. Would you like to list some of your more noteworthy alumni?
Autonomy was the most successful company that started here. It started in one room. About 2 years later, it was a FTSE Top 100 company. It was still in the Innovation Centre because there wasn't appropriate space for it outside the centre. Symbionics was another successful company, but they again started in one unit and they sold out to the American company for about £30 million, having grown the company to be employing at well over 100 people and making profits in the millions.
In 2004, I found a quote that you made along the lines of Cambridge has failed to fulfil its potential. Now you are moved on from the Innovation Centre and involved in many other fields of activity. Do you still feel the same way?
I think that since I retired formally, things have improved fantastically for Cambridge. Certainly I would revisit my statement of 2004, probably not realising that Arm and Autonomy were both FTSE top 100 companies. For a town of 100,000 people to create two top 100 companies, very significant. It was said or thought in the early part of this century that Cambridge companies couldn't grow. Well, they can't grow around Cambridge in a traditional sense. In other words, you don't have miles of workshops or factories employing thousands of people, but they can grow in a distributed sense, and you can have the headquarters like in Cambridge, but in fact other people are actually manufacturing the chips or doing the selling, and they have offices overseas. So in fact you can grow very substantial companies, and we have done so.
This is In Your Company on Cambridge 105 with me, Sam Davis, and my very special guest, Charles Cotton. So, Charles, as Walter has explained, by the mid-1970s, a lot of the necessary support infrastructure was in place. There was working space available, there were ambitious technologists, and there was investment available too to get these businesses off the ground. Can you then summarise the process by which Cambridge moved from entrepreneurial ambition towards the reality of building the billion-dollar companies that we have here today? And also, Walter referenced the Siegel-Quincy report. Could you drop in a few lines on what that was all about as well?
Yeah, sure. So at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 1980s, something really extraordinary happened, and we had what was memorialised in a television programme a few years ago now called the Home Computer Wars. And this was the time when Clive Sinclair, behind Sinclair Research, and Herman Hauser and Chris Curry behind Acorn, you know, started their home computer businesses, which of course put Cambridge very firmly in the minds of teenagers and parents who were expecting their children to be using their home computers for educational purposes. In fact, many of them were playing games at around that time. But what that period did was to put two companies, Sinclair and Acorn, in the minds of most of the people across the UK, and really started positioning Cambridge as the centre of these technological activities. So I would see that early 1980s as being that seminal seminal moment when Cambridge moved from a small city into one which received both national and international renown by virtue of those two companies.
And the Siegel Quince Weeksteed report was really the culmination of that process of becoming visible.
That's right. So 1985 really sort of occurred right at the pinnacle of the success of Sinclair and Acorn, and we were waiting for that report to come out and read it through very carefully. And frankly, most of us were amazed at how many companies had emerged during the period from 1960. If I remember rightly, it was close to 400 companies had been founded in that time period up until the point where Sinclair and Acorn came onto the scene and really put Cambridge onto the map.
And so from then onwards, there has been a snowballing effect, if you like. The companies that you're talking about then had offshoots which became successful in their own right or didn't. But the people who didn't make successes of those companies, many of them then learnt lessons and went away and started again. Something that Walter Herriot refers to as a compost heap effect. And by the mid-1990s, we really were starting to get companies of significant scale here. And of course, the most noteworthy of those is really Arm. And I think by examining Arm's experience, we can understand the process of growing a company of scale in the city. I, as you know, I was lucky enough to interview Warren East a couple of weeks ago. He's recently stepped down as chairman of Arm. Under his leadership, that company grew to employ around 2,500 people worldwide. And has a market value now of £12 billion. So let's listen to what Warren has to say about how Arm moved from its humble origins to world domination.
In 1994-95, we were still very much a startup, and you know, any business is good business because it's bringing in money. However, of course, to grow a business, yes, you need to bring money in, but you also need to focus your resources on what's going to lead to genuine long-term business growth. And so in about 1995-96 we felt strong enough to decide that we're going to focus on mobile technology, and we focused on mobile technology for a couple of reasons. The Arm products were their key technical difference was their ability to be low power, consume very little energy. So that lent itself to battery-powered products, and mobile phones, obviously a classic example of a very portable battery-powered product. That was one reason. And the other reason was that we felt that mobile phones were going to be pretty high volume. And the business model that we had developed at Arm was to sell design licenses for a chunk of money, and then earn money when our licensees, our semiconductor partners, sold their chips to companies who were building things like phones. And so if we had a high volume opportunity, then we'd earn more royalty. And that was the rationale for focusing on mobile, the sort of combined thing.
Okay, and it's worth noting that you turned down the opportunity to go to Texas Instruments in America to come to Arm. Did you feel that there was the scope in 1994 for it to become the powerhouse that it's become subsequently?
Well, that was a personal decision. My wife had already worked for a Cambridge startup, and I'd worked for Texas Instruments, and so it was my turn. That said, I remember very clearly my interview with the then CEO at Arm, and he spoke so enthusiastically about the huge opportunity that you know, it really was a good sales pitch for the business. And subsequently, of course, I gave the same sales pitch, and was delighted when various key employees have come along and joined us, and we've managed to turn that vision into a reality. We used to talk about a day when there would be one Arm chip for every person on the planet, when the planet's population was about 5 billion. The planet's population is now about 7 billion, and this year arms partners are going to ship about 10 billion chips just in the one year.
So world domination is just around the corner for Arm. You stepped down in July this year, but that's very much a positive decision for the company. You talked about the need to bring in some fresh oversight to take you forwards to the next generation of products and technology. Where do you think that's going? What are going to be the key themes in that next stage?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, when you have a technology business, people think that, you know, it's very fast moving, and it is relatively compared with some industries, but it still takes a very long time for technology to develop. And the reason that I'm stepping down was not just about getting new blood in for today, it was about making sure that we have new blood and we have an invigorated team still in 2020, when this sort of next phase that I envisage for Arm is ready to start really contributing to revenue and sales. So that's the first thing. It's quite a long way out, and therefore I don't think I can tell you exactly what Arm's going to be doing in 2020 to 2030, but I think for fairly certain we're going to be building on the platform that Arm's created. The 10 billion chips that are shipping this year will probably have turned into 20 billion chips or something like that by that time, and Arm's business will be what it is today in terms of revenue from those chip shipping, but the new components will be technology that enables services delivered over the products that those chips are found in.
You have said some reasonably critical things about a lack of ambition in the UK technology sector. I think I'm correct in saying in the past you've talked about the UK being small in terms of global technology. Do you think Cambridge is the only place where Arm could have happened the way it has done?
I think Cambridge is a bit special. I think it's a fantastic mix and ambition, and pushing the boundaries have been part of what's driven the whole sort of Cambridge phenomenon over the last 50 or so years. And one of the things that I do find frustrating is people being negative about business in Britain, not just technology, about business generally. And then you get certain areas where there are sparks of entrepreneurs. And Cambridge is one of those fantastic places for it, where there's a lot of support infrastructure for growing businesses that has grown up around the technology companies and the biotech companies literally over the last whole of the last 50 years. It's been a gradual accumulation. And what I find a little frustrating is people assuming that, you can just press a switch somewhere and turn it on somewhere else, overnight. You can't. Because it is very much about the culture and the attitudes and the thought processes and the ambitions. It isn't just about telling the banks to go and lend more money to small businesses. That's not sufficient. It's the whole package. And that's what makes Cambridge special.
So how many more Arms do you think Cambridge can realistically grow over a 20-year time frame?
Well, that's a very open question, but put it this way, I don't see barriers to more Arms over the next 20 years. I mean, we'll have to see what comes along. But this is a great place in which to do it. I've gone on record plenty of times as saying that, if Arm had been based in Silicon Valley, then, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. Arm wouldn't exist. Arm consistently took a global approach to the market, but in our space, the technology area, where actually there is a lot of business in Silicon Valley, we were different. We had the sort of the Cambridge phenomenon, the brand, everything behind us, but we were different, and that got us noticed.
So, Charles, can we go back to this issue of scale that Warren touched on? He says that he perceives no barriers to the creation of more big companies in Cambridge. Can you see anything that might knock the wheels off the wagon, or is this momentum set to continue?
I think the driver for that momentum is very much down to the University of Cambridge, and I think we have Alec Burrows, Lord Burrows, to thank for his period when he was Vice-Chancellor of the University from the late 1990s, for many of the positive things that have happened since then, since networks and things like that. But I do believe that the university and the research work that's done there has lain behind so much of the very successful companies in the Cambridge area, not least on the IT side, and obviously Arm is one of the key company in the IT side, but there have been some wonderful companies on the biotechnology and pharmaceutical side which have emerged as well. And I'd put that down to the work that Alec Burrows really supported, linking the university to the Cambridge phenomenon, to the cluster of companies in this area.
So if the growth does continue at the rate it's currently at, we already have, I think, 13 companies, each of which has a stock market valuation of $1 billion plus. That's great for UK PLC as a whole. What does it mean for Cambridge as a city? And what would you say to the people who argue that the thing is now overheating, there's too much development going on here, and the growth needs to be spread out to other clusters, such as, for example, Silicon Roundabout in London?
I think that that's the normal fears that people have as change takes place. If people are in control of change, they're comfortable with it. If they're not in control of change, it can be an uncomfortable experience. But I think that there is much that can be done in the Cambridge area to the benefit of Cambridge, and that involves much more joined-up thinking. I think if you take the university, you take the Cambridge phenomenon, you take the city council, the county council, and so on, we don't act in concert to the benefit of the Cambridge area. In fact, if you take each of those, I would say that Cambridge performs as less than the sum of its parts when it has the opportunity to be equal to or greater than the sum of its parts. And certainly one of the organizations called Cambridge Ahead, which is shortly to come into existence, very much takes that point of view, that there is so much more that Cambridge can do, both from the benefits to the people who live here already and to the benefits of future people that will come to live in this area.
And in terms of the discussion about competition or collaboration, Oxford University is expressing ambitions about building a technology cluster to rival that we have in Cambridge. As I said, the government is giving quite a lot of support to this initiative called Silicon Roundabout in London. Do we regard those as threats, or are they so close geographically that actually we should all be pulling together and trying to collaborate?
I think it's absolutely great that Oxford and Cambridge, and for that matter, if we can do Newcastle and Manchester and Birmingham and so on, I think that's great for the UK. And I would absolutely support their initiatives behind that. So I think the more the better from a UK perspective. And frankly, competition is good for Cambridge as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think our time is just about up, but I hope that's provided a flavour, at least, of what the Cambridge phenomenon is all about. My thanks to Walter and to Warren for their contributions. And Charles, thank you so much for your expert insight and for coming here today. It's been a real pleasure to have you here. To continue this theme, in our next show, I'll be interviewing some of the entrepreneurs who are driving the next phase of the phenomenon and finding out what they're trying to achieve. But in the meantime, if you have any questions or feedback, please email us. Our address is inyourcompany@cambridge105.fm. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Keep up to date with all the latest sporting action on 105 Sport every Saturday afternoon from 4. Join me, Chris Stewarden, and the rest of the 105 Sports team for latest news, conference and Premier League goals as they go in, special features on local sports clubs, and plenty of controversial insight and opinion on the previous 7 days in world sport. Plus, throughout the football season, we'll be broadcasting live from the Arkostings Abbey Stadium for all of Cambridge United's Saturday home games. We'll have fans forums, player interviews, interviews, post-match reports, and of course live second half commentary on the Ewes throughout the season. What a goal from Cunnington in the first minute. That's 105 Sport, live from 4 till 6 p.m. every Saturday, right here on Cambridge 105.